So remember the chiral superfield. And that sort of expansion and we showed that in components this turned into the kinetic terms as well as some interactions. And a scale of potential for that point. Now, let's just generalize this quickly. So if we have many chiral superfields, the generalization here is obvious. We're just going to have d squared w by d phi I, d phi j, psi I, psi j, minus the sum over all the i's dw by d phi I squared. So we just get the same thing for all of them. And let me just record here, we might imagine a slightly more general situation where we might be interested in higher dimension operators. So w is totally general. But here we've been restricting ourselves to just the dimension 4, the lowest dimension operators here. A general point is that the Kähler and super, sorry, the these d4 theta and d squared theta terms, without any derivatives, describe the two derivative Lagrangian. Okay? There are other supersymmetric terms I can write down. Okay, I can write down extra things, for example, I can write down things here that have d by dy nu of the superfields, and I can contract those derivatives, and all of that would be supersymmetric, but it has extra derivatives in it. Okay. Similarly here, I can put all sorts of other terms that have more derivatives in them. But there's a unique form of a supersymmetric Lagrangian with two derivatives. Okay. And that form is given by a general function of phi and phi dagger. There's many of them. That's called the Kähler potential. This is the superpotential. And I'll leave it as an exercise for you to work out how all these interactions are changed in the presence of the Kähler potential. But we will do, let's just do one of them because it's very easy to do. Let's just see what the potential turns into. Okay? So for the potential, remember, it's very easy to look at the potential because we just remove all derivatives everywhere. Okay? Out of here, I just get a theta squared, theta bar squared, fi fj star d squared k by d phi I d phi j star. Okay? So when I expand the Kähler potential out, so beforehand, this is just delta ij, and so we just got f star I, f star j. From here, we still get fi dw by d phi I. Okay. So now when I solve for the f, I get that f is the inverse of this matrix times dw by d phi. So when I look at the actual potential then becomes this inverse matrix, k inverse I j bar, if you like, d squared w d phi I d phi star j. So where I should say, kij bar, which is where this is the derivative inverse. So this kij bar is often called the Kähler metric. Dw by d phi I, dw star by d phi star j. Okay. So in the particular case of just one field, it would be 1 over k double prime, or d squared k by d phi dagger. times dw by d phi mod square. Okay. All right, so that's the general situation for just chiral superfields. Let's now talk about the gauge multiplet that we've found. And I'm going to do this a little more rapidly because it's basically the same. So remember, delta phi went like zeta psi, and delta psi went like zeta bar times the derivative on phi. So, and phi and psi were put into a chiral multiplet with each other, with phi as the lowest component. Okay? Now, remember, delta lambda goes like zeta f, and delta f goes like zeta derivative on lambda. Okay? So this looks very much the same, except the lowest component of the multiplet would be the gaugino rather than the scalar. Okay? So there is indeed a superfield which has that property. It's a chiral superfield again, and I'll just tell you what it is, because it'll look, the answer is more or less obvious. So the lowest component is lambda, but this chiral superfield itself has a spinner index alpha. Okay, this is called the gauge superfield, W alpha. And so its theta component, everything has got to have an alpha index, so it's a theta component that has a piece that looks like F mu nu, but I have to contract the indices. So again, remember we had our friend sigma mu, sigma bar nu, which can help contract the mu nu indices. And there's also something that can be proportional to delta alpha beta, and that ends up being the analog of the auxiliary term we had before. And then I have plus theta squared times sigma mu alpha dot d mu lambda bar alpha dot. Okay. So that's a chiral superfield. And now we could ask, what is the kinetic term for the gauge multiplet in terms of this superfield? And so now, let's see, what is the mass dimension of W? The mass dimension of W is 3/2. Okay? So let's try the same thing we did before for the gauge multiplet. Remember, the dumbest thing we tried was integral of d squared theta phi squared, and that didn't work for many reasons. But this is now going to work. Let's say I have W alpha. Okay, that's what it would have to be in order to be Lorentz invariant. Now what is the mass dimension? That's 3 plus 1 is 4. So this already has the correct dimensions. So this must be the kinetic term. Okay? And you can indeed see it is the kinetic term. Let's, for example, look. There's a theta, so I have to pull out a theta squared component out of WW. Okay? So the theta squared component I can get by pulling out the lowest component from one W and the highest component from the other one. So look at what that is. That's the gaugino times d gaugino bar. That's exactly the kinetic term for the gaugino. Okay? Another way I can get it is to take the square of the theta term. Okay? If I take the square of the theta term, I'm going to get 2 f mu nu's. So that's the kinetic term for the gauge field. Okay? And I'm also going to get a d squared, just like I got before for f star f. This d is the auxiliary field in this case. Okay. But there's something a little more interesting, slightly more interesting, which is that in the case where it was phi dagger phi, you know, the coefficient here has to be real, and by rescaling phi, I can always make it equal to 1. Okay? But there's something a little interesting here. The coefficient of W alpha, well, let me write it down as, so let me put a minus a quarter g squared here. So if that minus a quarter g squared, that turns into the usual kinetic terms that you know and love. But it could be complex. There's no reason this coefficient has got to be real, because this is inside, this is a nice holomorphic object. I'm adding plus Hermitian conjugate to this. Okay. So what could the interpretation of the imaginary part of this thing be? Let me write plus I question mark for now. There is one term we didn't write down, if you recall. Well, when we wrote down the free action, we wrote down F squared and the Gugino kinetic term. But there is a theta angle that I could have also written down, theta FF dual. Okay. And that's, in fact, the imaginary part. Okay. So when you really do it, see the sigma mu, sigma bar nu has a piece, when you contract things, that just looks like delta delta, and there's a piece that looks like the epsilon mu alpha beta that turns us into the that turns us into FF dual. So let me then actually write this kinetic term down just so you have the answer. So if I write b squared theta a half s, then s is minus a half s. S is 1 over 2 g squared minus I, because we have so many thetas running around, let me just call it theta sub angle over 16 pi squared. Okay. All right. Very good. Now, so that's the analog of F mu nu. The analog of F mu nu in superspace is W alpha. Okay. And it unites the Gugino and F mu nu together. So let's finally figure out what's the analog of A mu itself directly. Okay. So in order to do that, let's go back to a chiral superfield. And let's imagine what would a local gauge transformation look like on a chiral superfield. Well, we want it to be something like e to the I theta of x phi, naive, right? But there's a few things about this. First of all, this phi is a function of y and theta. So this really should be e to the I, oh, too many thetas again. Alpha of y and theta now, phi of y and theta. Okay. And also notice that because this is complex, there's no phi daggers anywhere. In fact, I'm automatically, let me just leave it at this for now. But alpha can be promoted to be itself a full chiral superfield. This is the point I want to make. Okay. So alpha doesn't have to be a real number. Alpha can be a full chiral superfield too. All right. Now let's look at this. So is this trivially invariant? Let's look trivially invariant. But it's not trivially invariant for the same reason that this thing had derivatives before, because this is phi of y and theta, and this is phi of y star and theta bar. Okay. So this is not, in fact, invariant. This goes over into d4 theta, phi dagger, e to the minus I alpha dagger, e to the I alpha phi. Okay. And these do not cancel because, again, they're evaluated at y star and at y. So what do I have to do to make it invariant? This is the usual way we introduce the gauge connection. But again, peculiarly, these things all look actually much simpler in superspace than you were used to in just thinking about gauge theory. See, what do we have to do here? I have to just introduce some object. I'll call it V. And just declare that V goes to V minus I alpha plus I alpha dagger when phi goes to e to the I alpha phi, and phi dagger goes to e to the minus I alpha dagger phi dagger. Okay? So here's a new object. This sucker has clearly got must have the gauge fields in it, because its transformation is making this theory invariant under local gauge transformations. Okay? Now V should be real. Clearly, because we want the whole thing to be real. I don't want it to be real. I like baby legs. So B is a real superfield. And so let's see what its components can be. Well, you'll notice that it's a real superfield, but I can do by making these superfield gate transformations. I clearly can add and subtract various things from the components of V. So if I'm being very pedantic, say V is some lowest component C of X plus theta, I don't know, zeta of X plus zeta bar of X plus, and here's the first interesting term, which I will give a nice name. Okay, so it's real. So, and maybe there's also a theta squared, B of X, since I don't care about it until I care about them. Okay? But then I have things like theta sigma mu, theta bar lambda bar. Okay, so I'm giving them prescient names, plus Hermitian conjugate, plus theta squared, theta bar squared, d. Okay? So I'm expanding the most general possible vector, real vector superfield. Okay, I've written down, I think, have I missed anything? I don't think I've missed anything. Okay. Huh? I'm just doing abelian. The non-abelian is not really different. Okay? That's right. But in the non-abelian case, it's not zero, and so it's not. Yes, it's totally, it's identical. Okay. And actually, the theta angle isn't really zero anyway. It's the integral of E dot B, and if E and B are non-zero at infinity, it's not even zero. No, but there is such a, anyway, that's not important stuff. Okay, so let's look at this. There's something relatively obvious here, which is that, for example, let's say I just make alpha a constant. Okay? A constant that's totally independent of theta. Totally independent of theta and theta bar. Well, if I do that, I can remove C. Okay? By making that transformation, I don't affect anything else, I just change C. Now, if you think a little bit more, if I make this a function, you see, this piece and that piece looks like a chiral superfield plus an anti-chiral superfield. Okay. So it's actually possible to partially fix this gauge by just declaring that all of these lower components of V vanish. Okay. So it's possible to choose alphas in such a way to make all the lower components of V, the part that naively looks like chiral plus anti-chiral, to make that vanish. Okay? That's partially fixing the gauge. That's called the Wessimino gauge. Okay? So the WZ gauge, you see, I've introduced a way more redundancy than even the standard gauge redundancy, right? Because the standard gauge redundancy will just e to the I alpha of X. I've introduced a buttload more gauge redundancy by making this huge by making it a general chiral superfield. And so I can fix a lot of that redundancy by choosing this WZ gauge. I'm still left with some. Okay? So WZ gauge is chosen so that V is equal to okay? Oh, there's a all right, and now you'll notice something cool. So now let's look at what this transformation actually let's look at what it actually looks like. Let me just make alpha of X, so alpha of Y and theta. Okay, let me just make this a function of Y. Okay, let me just make this f of Y only. If I make it f of y, then this is f of x minus I theta mu theta bar, okay, which is f of x minus I sigma mu theta bar d mu f, okay, right? plus, don't care about the rest. Let me care about the rest. It's plus, So notice that I alpha minus I alpha dagger, if F is complex, is then this lowest part. But it has a piece that looks like theta sigma mu theta bar d mu of the imaginary part of F plus dot dot. So that means that it's shifting. So this corresponds to a mu goes to a mu plus d mu, the imaginary part of F. Okay. So again, that's how you see the usual gauge transformations buried inside these much more innocuous looking. OK? All right, so WZ gauge fixes this larger chiral gauge transformation down to the usual familiar gauge redundancy. Okay, yes?
Are we pretty sure that you can choose alpha? Because you say that alpha is the chiral superfield and then so just choose the same.
What you can do is actually do it in turn. You can first, I'll leave that as an exercise for you. Okay, I will tell you how to begin doing it. So if you start making alpha purely real, you can eliminate C. Then you add a theta squared term to it, and you can eliminate these guys. And so thereby, you can inductively eliminate all of these, and then show that you're left with that. Okay, so that's an exercise. Okay, but I just want to show you that it's plausible, and that it contains the standard gauge invariance in it. Okay, very good. So now we're done. So now we can write any Suzy gauge theory. In principle, I should tell you exactly the relationship between V and W in superspace, but it doesn't matter. I've just packaged the same information in two different superfields. One of them is the vector superfield, one of them is the analog of the connection, one of them is the analog of F mu nu directly, and I've just shown you what they are. Okay? That's all you need to know. You don't ever need to look at a D bar or anything like that. So let's just write down the final answer for a general supersymmetric theory. Okay, so the Lagrangian looks like d4 theta, and in general we'll have the phi dagger e to the v a t a phi. If it's a general group G, the t's are the generators, okay, plus v squared theta a half s W alpha A, plus D squared theta times the superpotential for the phi. And so I'm grouping all the fields into one large vector phi when I'm writing this, so it's a very compact notation. All right, then the Lagrangian becomes the kinetic terms, the gauge kinetic terms. Okay? And it has some Yukawa couplings, and it has a potential for phi. So everything is now going to be determined by, so now I just have to tell you what these things are. So the Yukawa couplings there are Yukawa couplings that come from the superpotential, and there is Yukawa couplings related to the gauge couplings, just as we anticipated last time. The Yukawa coupling from the superpotential is the same as before, so this is d squared w, d phi I, d phi j, psi I, psi j. The Yukawa couplings that come from the gauge interactions, now this comes from just expanding phi dagger e to the d phi. Okay, so we can see that's going to contain some interesting Yukawa couplings. For example, from the theta squared theta bar lambda bar component, okay, there's the Gaugino from that. That hits a fermion from here and gets a scalar from there. So that's going to have phi star, fermion, Gaugino. Okay, and that's coming from exactly the same kinetic term here. So that ends up being root 2, when you do it properly, root 2g, lambda a, phi dagger, pa psi, plus Hermitian conjugate. So again, this is precisely what we anticipated from our simple example, is a Yukawa coupling whose strength is proportional to the gauge coupling, and that's all it can be. It can only be phi dar. Because the lambdas are in the adjoint, they can only be phi dagger psi, because phi and psi have the same quantum numbers. Okay, so that comes from this, that comes from that. And the potential also has two terms. It's the sum of the Fi mod squared, just as we saw, plus a half G squared dA dA. This is the new auxiliary fields we got, where Fi is just dW, Fi star is dW by d phi I, and the dAs are phi dagger pa phi. Okay. And that again, you can see there's an interaction that looks like phi dagger ta phi d, right? Because there's phi dagger phi, and d has the theta squared theta bar squared component d. So there's phi dagger phi d. And then there was the d squared from the kinetic term, so again. All right, so that's it. So that's what it looks like in superspace. And this is what it looks like in components for the most general supersymmetric approach. All right, one final comment. A few comments. So comment one, let me just make So SUSY theories can have interesting global symmetries, of course. There are the obvious global symmetries that treat every member of a multiplet the same. So, you know, for example, phi goes to some e to the I qa pa phi. That could be a global symmetry with some generators ta, theta a. Okay. But there's also an interesting kind of symmetry that supersymmetric theories can have that treats the components of a multiplet differently. And these are called R-symmetries. And you can actually think of them as an interesting symmetry directly in superspace. So if we have phi that depends on y and theta, for example, I can have a transformation where this goes into some so if it's just this, this would just be some kind of normal U1 transformation. Okay? But I can do something else. I can also rotate the theta angle. So by convention, I'll rotate the theta angle for the charge 1. Okay? This might be a symmetry. This has a chance of being a symmetry. Let me put a minus sign here. Notice what this does is it rotates the lowest component of phi. The lowest component of phi would have charge Q. The fermion component of phi would have charge Q minus 1, because of that minus 1 there. Okay. And the F component of phi would have charge Q minus 2. Okay. Now, is it possible for the Lagrangian to have a symmetry like this? Well, for example, let's look at d squared theta W of phi. This would go over to d squared theta W of phi of e to the minus I alpha theta. Well, that looks like it could be. I just have to redefine theta. But if I do that, I pick up a Jacobian, which is either the 2i theta, 2i alpha. Okay. So W itself needs to have charge under the symmetry in order for the whole thing to be invariant. Okay. And furthermore, So, and exactly the same thing, for example, the kinetic term, d squared theta w alpha squared for the gauge field, similarly, if I do this kind of transformation, w needs to have a charge, which means the gaugino has to have a charge, okay? Because the lowest component of w is the gaugino. So instead of doing this, I mean, we can do the superspace Jacobian crapola, or we can just go to this component Lagrangian. One thing I want to emphasize is that you know, superspace is nice for some things, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And it's really important to like also have a good feeling of components for what's going on. As you see, it's not very complicated. So you can easily go back and forth between both what was it thinking about. So an R-symmetry is a symmetry that gives a gaugino a charge of 1. Okay, so we can define it like that. So let's say we give the gaugino a charge 1. Okay? Now, because the gaugino has charge 1, if the scalar has charge q, so that has charge minus q, the fermion must have charge q minus 1. Okay? Clear? Now, in order for now, so everything else, this just it's just a u1, so the potential is invariant. But here we have an opportunity for trouble. Here we have an opportunity for trouble because this would have charge qi minus 1, qj minus 1, okay? And this, so, but this has the charge of w minus qi minus qj because the phis are downstairs. So for this whole thing to be invariant, the charge of w has got to equal 2. So if you can find the U1 where if you forget about thetas and everything, all that crap, if you just find the U1 where if you act on it, the superpotential homogeneously has a charge 2, then that U1, those charges turn into good R charges, where the scalars have those charges, the fermions have those charges minus 1. Okay? So that is an R symmetry. So an R symmetry is phi has charge Q, phi I has charge Q, psi I has charge qi minus 1, gaugino has charge 1, and w must have charge 2. Okay? So these are sometimes useful. All right. Okay, so now, so that's the most general supersymmetric Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is supersymmetric. We should ask under what conditions is actually the vacuum itself supersymmetric? Lagrangian is supersymmetric. When is the vacuum supersymmetric? Well, the vacuum is super. Remember, supersymmetry is translation in superspace. So the vacuum is supersymmetric if the field configuration is translationally invariant in superspace. Now, any ordinary vacuum that we're talking about is certainly translationally invariant in space. So we're going to be putting all spatial derivatives to zero. If we put all spatial derivatives to zero, any superfield, phi, w, any superfield, if spatial derivatives are put to zero, becomes a lowest component plus theta times and theta squared and so on, times higher components. So these are all, well, this is a graph screen. Actually, so most generally, we don't have backgrounds that have spinner beds. Okay? So any superfield in a conventional vacuum, where it's translation invariant in space, will look like C plus theta squared something, plus theta bar squared something, plus theta squared theta bar squared something. Okay? So whatever configuration we have, in superspace, the VABs will look like this. Okay? But if any of these numbers are non-vanishing, that breaks translational invariance in superspace. Translational invariance in superspace, after all, just translates the theta variables. So in order to preserve supersymmetry, it had better be that all of these things are zero. Now remember that for us, the only place these come in is in chiral superfields have a theta squared f, and a vector superfield had a theta squared theta bar squared b. Okay? So in order for supersymmetry to be good, we have to have that the f and b components are all equal to zero. So that is a supersymmetric vacuum. So we have to be able to simultaneously satisfy. That means we have to simultaneously be able to satisfy that the F and B are equal to zero. But note that the structure of the scalar potential was indeed the sum of the F terms squared and the sum of the D terms squared. Okay, so where Fi, remember, W by D phi I, DA is phi dagger TA phi. Okay, very good. So having Suzy is in one-to-one correspondence with making the scalar potential vanish. So and vice versa. So if we can find any place where the scalar potential vanishes, we have a supersymmetric vacuum, and vice versa. Now, we haven't talked about the Suzy algebra much. But in fact, this fact follows also directly from the structure of the algebra. That's another exercise that I'll have to do. OK? That's a trivial exercise. All right, so that's what, so there's a supersymmetric Lagrangian. Those are supersymmetric vacuum. Now, what if we break supersymmetry? Of course, in the real world, we want to break supersymmetry. So let's first figure out. So suppose we want to spontaneously break supersymmetry. So without doing any work, let's figure out some basic properties. So supersymmetry is a global symmetry. It's a fermionic global symmetry, but it's a global symmetry. So what do you expect should happen when you spontaneously break it? There should be a Goldstone boson. Oops. But it can't be a Goldstone boson. So there's got to be a Goldstone fermion. So if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken, first of all, there must be a Goldstone fermion. Often called a Goldstino. Now, actually, the properties of this Goldstino are more or less completely fixed properties of Goldstino are more or less totally fixed by symmetries, and we'll come back to it in a second. But just in order to see this very directly, let's just say we had a theory. So here's the potential, okay? And we are looking for stationary point of the potential, so vacuum. So stationary point will, for example, satisfy that dV by d phi j is equal to zero, which tells me that d squared w by d phi I d phi j times dw star by d phi I is equal to zero. Okay? And now, suppose that in this vacuum, the F is not equal to zero. So remember, F is exactly equal to Fi is precisely dw star by d phi star I. So this precisely tells me that d squared w by d phi d phi j d phi I times fi is equal to 0. But if fi is not equal to 0, then we just exhibited a 0 eigenvector of this matrix, d squared w by d phi j d phi I. But in the vacuum, the matrix d squared w by d phi I, d phi j, d phi I is precisely the fermion mass matrix. Remember, there was a psi d squared w by d phi d phi. So when I put that in the vacuum, when I put everything to its vacuum expectation value, that is the fermion mass matrix. And we see precisely when supersymmetry is broken, the fermion mass matrix has a zero eigenvalue. That's the gold standard. That's guaranteed by supersymmetry. In fact, we can see that more conceptually because whenever you have a broken symmetry, the Goldstone object is the thing which shifts under the symmetry. Okay. So we should have the Goldstino chi should be an object such that delta chi is, so it's a fermion, is equal to zeta alpha, where zeta is the supersymmetry variation. Okay? Now let's see, how does that actually come about? In the underlying theory, this is the Goldstino. In the underlying theory, I have some size, and the variation of the size, remember, do have a piece that go like zeta f. When I put everything to its ven, the d phi's vanish, so the variation of psi is zeta f. And if the sum of the f's are non-zero, then the psi's are shifting under the supersymmetry. Okay. And in fact, the combination f star I, psi I, precisely that combination over the sum of fi mod squared, this combination is the Goldstino. It precisely shifts under the global symmetry. Delta chi alpha is equal to zeta alpha. So it's the fermions projected on the F components. And of course, the generalization including the D components in the gauge genomes is clear. And furthermore, again, we could have just guessed this directly from general considerations. The Lagrangian for the Goldstino, well, it's just a free massless fermion. Well, sorry, it's a massless fermion. But chi, the Goldstino, naturally has units of zeta, which is minus a half. Okay? So the kinetic term here naturally has units of dimension 4. Okay? That should be the vacuum energy. That's the natural thing that's the order parameter for supersymmetry breaking and is the vacuum energy. And indeed, that's exactly also what we get in this explicit construction. This component precisely sticks in front of the kinetic term for the size and overall sum of fi mod squared. Okay. So when we spontaneously break supersymmetry, there is a Goldstein. And we'll come back to talk about the Goldstein a little bit more. But let me make one quick comment. What happens? So we probably don't have these massless Goldstinos around in the real world. But that's okay because supersymmetry is actually gauged by gravity. Okay? So if we have supersymmetry in gravity, then there's a superpartner of the graviton, which is the gravitino. The gravitino has spin 3/2, so it has two helicities again. Any massless particle has two helicities. There's two helicities for the gravitino. There's two helicities for the Goldstino. And what should happen? What should happen is that the gravitino should eat the Goldstino and become massive. Okay? And the counting works because there's two helicities for the gravitino, two for the Goldstino, 4, and 4 is the number of spin degrees of freedom of a massive spin 3/2 particle. 3/2, 1/2, minus 1/2, minus 3/2. Okay? Okay? So what should happen is that with gravity, the Goldstino becomes the longitudinal component of the gravitino. And without knowing anything about supergravity, we can estimate the mass. What should the mass of the gravitino be? Okay. Well, anytime we have symmetry breaking, it's always m squared is g squared, f squared, v squared. Okay. It has to be that. It has to be proportional. Okay. In this case, so m3 half squared, the g squared here is 1 over m Planck squared, or g Newton. And the analog of v squared, the order parameter, has units of the vacuum energy of this v naught. So that's the mass of the gravitino. So if I put it another way, so m3 half is like f or d, whichever it is, but the Suzy breaking thing over m1. And now numerically, it's a question of how big that scale of supersymmetry breaking is in the real world. Okay? If the f or d's are bigger than 10 to the 11 GeV, then numerically, the m3 half is in excess of 10 TeV. 1 TeV, let's call it a TeV or higher. Okay, so for high f, for f bigger than 10 to the 10 GeV squared, and we'll come back to why we're talking about such huge scales here in the standard model we want a TeV for these things. But anyway. If that's what it is in the gravitino, is heavier than a TeV, and we more or less don't care about it. Well, we care about it for cosmology, but we're not going to talk about it. We have some TeV particle sitting around that has incredibly weak couplings to everything else, so we don't care very much about it. If f is a lot smaller than this, then the gravitino is very light. And then from the point of view of particle physics, we don't care about the gravitino. We really care about the Goldsteino. Okay, yes, the Goldsteino has become the longitudinal component of the gravitino. But for all intents and purposes, any process that we're talking about is going to involve very high energies compared to the mass of the gravitino. So once again, we don't care about this transverse 1 over m Planck coupled sucker. We care about the longitudinal component that's going to be a lot more strongly coupled, which is the Goldsteino. So on this limit, we can just think in terms of the Goldsteino. Think with Goldsteino, but we have to keep it around. We have to remember that there's a light Goldsteino around, and that has a dramatic impact on the phenomenology. Okay. So there's two classes of theories where you don't care about the gravitino because it's at a TeV or heavier. When it's lighter than a TeV, then in fact the lightest new object around is the Goldsteino, and you have to think about it. And we'll talk about exactly what controls its coupling constants in a moment. Okay. Now. Okay. So we're continuing to talk about supersymmetry breaking. We're talking in great generality here. If we break supersymmetry, there's a Goldsteino. We know its order parameter. We know the low part of the low energy Lagrangian. Let's come up with a simple specific example. So let's see, can we break Suzy? With one chiral superfield. Let's call it with a single chiral superfield X. Okay, well, remember, suppose we don't want there to be any supersymmetric. We just want to find vacuum that doesn't have. Let's ask a perhaps harder question. Is it possible to find the theory with a single chiral superfield which has no supersymmetric vacua at all? Okay, where the global minimum of the potential does not have D equals zero. Well, that sounds hard because I have a W of X. In order to have no supersymmetry breaking vacua, it must be impossible to solve dW by dx equals zero. Okay? I should not be able to solve that. All right, but if I have some generic polynomial, I can always solve complex polynomials. Remember, this is holomorphic. So complex polynomials always have solutions. So it seems like I always have supersymmetric vacuum. this is generalized. If you have many chiral superfields, then we have to be able to make it impossible to solve all of these simultaneously. But that's also impossible. Generic superpotentials, I can always solve. I can solve these. I can solve them. I can find simultaneous solutions to all of them. All right, let's go back to this first one, though. So it seems like if I want to demand that there's no supersymmetric vacua, this is almost impossible. Of course, almost impossible. That sounds a little stupid. We can give a trivial counterexample. What's the most trivial counterexample here? Right. So let's say W is equal to some constant mu squared times x. Okay? That is a trivial counterexample. But actually, let's take a look at this for a second. So W is equal to mu squared x. Okay, W is mu squared x, and the Kähler potential is just x staggered x, as we were saying, then what is the potential? The potential is just dw by dx squared is mu to the fourth. This is a little bit stupid, apparently, because it's still a completely free theory. I've just added a vacuum energy. Okay? The vacuum energy is mu to the fourth. Okay? V is a function of x. It's just mu to the fourth. So notice, this breaks supersymmetry, but actually, it doesn't determine the vacuum uniquely. That can have any value of x. The potential is still totally dependent of x. Now, okay, but it's formally broken supersymmetry. Ah, who's the Goldstino? The Goldstino is just the fermion in x. It's a massless fermion. Broken supersymmetry, there it is. Okay? It all seems a little bit trivial. But in fact, this really has the seeds of everything in it. So let's examine two different issues. The first issue is, well, what happened to this generic bullshit theorem? Well, let's see what happens. So we've after all chosen a very special superpotential here, mu squared x. What happens if I add some term here? I don't know, epsilon x squared. Right? If I add epsilon x squared, then the potential becomes dw by dx mod squared, and it becomes mu squared plus epsilon x squared. Now this has a supersymmetric minimum. Right? Now the supersymmetric minimum is that x equals minus mu squared over epsilon. Right? So what's happening to this picture of the potential is that, in fact, there is a potential with zero out here, right? And actually, this is so I'm slightly curving. I'm slightly curving this potential, right? So as epsilon goes to zero, I'm sending that supersymmetric point off to infinity. But for any non-zero epsilon, there is a supersymmetric minimum. Okay? So you see, what's really going on here, the way it's broken supersymmetry, as I vary parameters generically, is I've just set the supersymmetric minimum to infinity. But there is a supersymmetric minimum there, very, very far away. Now, the only way to guarantee that supersymmetric, so there's always a supersymmetric minimum around. Sometimes it's at infinity, but there's always a supersymmetric minimum around. The only way I can guarantee that supersymmetric minimum is always at infinity is to make the non-generic choice for the superpotential. You see, in this case, it's guaranteed by a symmetry. There is an R symmetry under which x has charge 2. Suppose I say there's an R symmetry under which x has R charge 2. Then the only term I can have in the superpotential is mu squared x. X squared, for example, doesn't work because the whole superpotential, remember, has to have R charge 2. So if I declare that X is R charge 2, then the only superpotential I can write down is this one, And then the supersymmetric minimum has been sent off to infinity. More generally, when you have many fields, the only way you can guarantee that the non-generic form of the superpotential is the one that doesn't that send the supersymmetric vacuum to infinity is to demand that the superpotential have an R symmetry.
Right.
No, no, it doesn't necessarily, but in order to have a hope, you see, if you have a generic superpotential, you always have a supersymmetric vacuum. And then the question is, can you send a supersymmetric vacuum to infinity? And you can only do that if the superpotential has an R symmetry. But I don't want to dwell on this point, because who cares if the supersymmetric minimum is at infinity? We don't care if the supersymmetric minimum very far away or not. We care that we can find some supersymmetric minimum. Okay? So in order to do that, non-supersymmetric minimum, let me go back to this example. And let me even forget the epsilon for a second. You see, and let me say another thing. It seems a little dramatic that you add a minuscule epsilon and all of a sudden you restore supersymmetry. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because with epsilon equals zero, you hadn't fixed the vacuum. Okay? With epsilon equals zero, there was this whole continuous degenerate set of vacua. And that's why when that happens, a tiny perturbation can now generate a tiny potential on that extra potential on that space and make a dramatic difference. So all we have to do is figure out how do we stick with this theory and not have an exactly flat potential. Well, that's really easy. That's really easy because, for instance, let's say that there are higher order terms in the Kähler potential. Let me write this one down. Minus x dagger x squared over m squared, for example. Okay. This could very easily come from integrating out some physics at higher scales. Okay? So, and again, normally we don't care about non-renormalizable terms except when they give you the leading effect for something. Okay? In this case, it just happens to be that the lowest theory left us with an exact degeneracy of vacua, so the leading effect that's going to lift them can come from higher dimension operators. Okay? Well, let's see what this does. Remember I told you that the potential is dw by the x mod squared, in this case divided by k double prime. D squared k by dx dagger. So this then just becomes, v then becomes mu to the fourth from the upstairs over 1 minus x dagger x over m squared. Okay? Plus dot, dot, dot. But note, if I just expand this upstairs, what is this doing? This is mu to the fourth plus mu to the fourth over m squared x dagger x plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? So what that means is that with that higher order term in the Kähler potential, the potential now looks like this. Okay? All right. Now, there's still a massless Goldstino, because the fermionic component is not affected by this, but I still have, okay. Now suppose I add plus epsilon x squared. Now that's not going to make, unless epsilon, for sufficiently small epsilon compared to mu squared over m squared, this is not going to make a big difference. Well, it will restore supersymmetry somewhere. That means that this potential will eventually be turned around somewhere, and there will be a supersymmetric point far away, still at x equals minus mu squared over epsilon.
Okay.
The epsilon is breaking the R symmetry. So you see the R symmetry isn't crucial. Okay. All that's needed is that there's going to be some, you know, it's just a question of competing parameters against each other. But for some range of, the R symmetry limit is convenient to make it clear there's a limit where we can study the potential cleanly. And then clearly in some neighborhood of that limit, I still have a supersymmetric vacuum, a non-supersymmetric vacuum, a supersymmetric vacuum. This is now generic. It doesn't force you to make very special choices. Okay. However, it's not the global minimum of the potential. Okay. It's a local minimum. But clearly, if epsilon is small enough, I can make this tunneling rate as tiny as I like. And so I can find supersymmetry breaking vacuum. Okay. So this just says that to have the Suzy breaking minimum as global minimum, this is very non-generic. to have Suzy breaking as a metastable minimum, this is very generic. It's the opposite. It's in fact hard to run across theories that don't do it. Okay? And you know, all of the business in the past year or so about the metastable vacua, I mean, this is the low energy description, universal description of all of this business. All right, so this is all just to say, so here's an incredibly simple theory of Suzy breaking. You know, there's no complicated anything, incredibly simple theory of Suzy breaking. Of course, if I want the Suzy breaking scale to be low compared to the Planck scale, the gut scale, for some reason, mu has to be small, but I can trigger mu by dimensional transmutation or by some other methods. Okay, so A, this is an incredibly simple theory of Suzy breaking. B, it also makes it clear that in this theory of Suzy breaking, I just end up with some, there's a nice description where I end up with some field X, which has a lowest component, and a little x, and an F component. Okay? And that's all of the effect of Suzy breaking is in the size of that F component. Okay? So in this model, that F component would be of order mu squared. Here it's order mu squared. Okay. Keep thinking really and rifling through these charts. All right. So any questions about that? Yes?
Can you show that you have actually a Constino and your metastable in?
You can show it. Well, so first of all, it's true, must be true on general grounds.
Yeah,
and secondly, you should really check. You should really check and see that with this higher order term of the Kettle, this will force you to work out the rest of the Lagrangian that I didn't work out for you. How do the K's affect other things? But anyway, you can see that there's a...
Is the vacuum defined there, or the vacuum that the metastable states is really definite? How you should calculate this, how you can show that
you expand the Lagrangian around x equals 0. You just expand it, and you see. There's nothing mysterious.
It seems that the curvature double derivative is not 0. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, the curvature double derivative isn't 0. That's and so the scalar is massive. The x scalar is massive.
Yeah.
But I've broken supersymmery. There's no reason why the scalars and the fermions have to be degenerate anymore. Okay. That's what was anomalous and weird about this lowest order theory. Is that it looks like you broke Suzy, but everything was still degenerate. I just added a non-zero vacuum in. Okay, but it's not as stupid as it seems, because any kind of physics at a high scale, when I integrate it out, it can generate an operator like this, and it can generate with the correct sign. So for example, what people call the O'Rafferty model, so this looks an incredibly simple way of breaking Suzy, and other things you may have seen have, you know, three superfield, blah, blah, blah. That's all in order to generate that operator. Okay, so that's all particular microscopic models for generating that correction to the Kettle correction. But who cares? Okay, we can just, as a low energy person, just write down what works. Okay. So anyway, for many, many years, this is the model I've had in the back of my mind for what Suzy breaking looks like. It's incredibly trivial, and it's actually correct. And every model of Suzy breaking looks like this at the end. Every single model. The reason is, let me explain this. This is a slightly important point. The reason is that if Suzy is broken in any weakly coupled regime, there must be some energy range in which you can unambiguously identify the superpartner of the Goldstino. Okay? Because, you know, eventually everything is becoming supersymmetric. So there's the Goldstino massless. But the Goldstino should go into a multiplet with somebody, okay? And so there's two things that could be its partner. It could be a Gagino or it could be a fermion. If it's a fermion, then there must be an energy range where the Goldstino is embedded into a single chiral superfield, X. And then you're done. I have to write down the effective theory for X. And this is the most general effective theory for X. The other possibility is that it's the superpartner of the Goldstino, is a gauge field. Okay, and that also happens, that's the so-called sort of Biot-Heliopoulos way of breaking supersymmetry, which I'm not talking about, partially because it's a little harder to realize it with gravity around. But anyway, you can do the same exercise for the Fi type term. Okay, so now we're getting finally to the heart of the matter for what is going to matter for the supersymmetric extension of the standard model. So we've broken supersymmetry. Now, suppose that there's just some way, and what's beautiful here is I don't have to talk about any of the specifics. There's some way that I attach, that I connect this sector that breaks supersymmetry to some other sector. Okay? Some other sector which is which contains, in the case that we're interested in, the fields of the MSSM, but let's just be general for the moment. Bunch of chiral superfields, vector superfields, other things like that. Okay? And there's some particles of mass m, or some physics of a scale m, or something, and I integrate them out, and so I'm going to get higher dimension operators linking this x sector to the sector that I'm interested in. Okay? So this is sometimes called hidden and visible, although really, it could be pretty damn unhidden. So they can have gauge interactions, direct interactions. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. What's important is, so now let's ask the question. Again, so I'm going to write down some higher dimension operators linking this sector to another. Now, higher dimension operators almost never matter, again, right? We almost never care about higher dimension operators. But what's going on here is that some of these higher dimension operators will have the property that because of supersymmetry breaking, they turn into operators of dimension 2 and 3, which are supersymmetry breaking in this theory. Okay. Now, of course, the coefficients will be small. The coefficients of those operators will be small. They'll be suppressed by powers of things in this scale divided by m. But even though they're small, we still care about them because they're relevant non-supersymmetric operators. And we can notice them at low energies. They give us masses, Egenoe masses, scalar masses, and agents. So let's just see that a little more concretely. So, for instance, suppose I have the operator d4 theta, x dagger x phi dagger phi. This is some operator that I might have. I could also have other things, like just x dagger over m, x over m, and so on. Okay. But let's focus on this one. This is some higher dimension operator. You would normally not care about it. But if I put x is equal to fx times theta squared, this contains something that looks like d4 theta squared theta bar squared, fx mod squared over m squared times phi dagger phi. But because of the theta squared theta bar squared here, I only pick up the lowest component of phi. And so this is a scalar mass. What else? Well, but I want to emphasize, there's an infinite number of higher dimension operators. Almost none of them matter. For example, I can have more derivatives here. I can have more derivatives there. And those will turn into other operators that break supersymmetry. We'll just talk about them briefly in a second. But the leading ones that I care about, even though, so you notice this is small, it's suppressed by m. But despite the fact that it's small, I care about it because it turns into a dimension 2 operator. This is a general fact that often happens, that they're so-called dangerously irrelevant operators, or operators that when you turn on vacuum expectation values turn into lower dimension operators. Okay, so this is a very generic phenomenon, but it doesn't happen. The vast majority of operators are totally irrelevant. Okay? So, another example is d squared theta x over m, so that's max and chiral and holomorphic, phi cubed. Okay? This is going to turn into, again, there's a theta squared here, so I'm just going to pull out the scalars. So this is fx over m phi cubed. So this isn't a mass, but it's a non-supersymmetric trilinear interaction between the phis. That's called an A-term. I'll be more systematic about this in a second. Okay? Or I can have d squared theta x over m w alpha squared. Okay? What does this do? Again, I pull out the theta squared here, and I just have lambda lambda. Okay? So this becomes fx over m lambda lambda. That's a Gugino mass. Gives a mass to the lambda without giving a mass to the gauge field, obviously. Okay, so this is a Gugino mass. So Majorana mass for the lambdas. Okay. Now, this general scale fx over m, let's call that scale m soft. That is the scale of the Susie breaking that's going to be visible. In the phi sector. Okay, so we're going to get, again, we get lambda lambda, we get phi cubed, we get phi star phi. Okay? And all of these things, this is like m soft, this is like m soft, this is like m soft squared, and so on. Okay? So this is the dominant way that Susie breaking is going to appear in the low energy theory. Now I want to emphasize something, because people don't often talk about it. There are also effects in this low energy theory that look like hard breakings of supersymmetry. What do I mean by hard? I mean, remember, these are called soft because they are lower dimension operators. They have mass dimension, okay? But supersymmetry gives you relations, as we saw. It gives you relations between Yukawa coupling and gauge coupling, Yukawa coupling, you know, all of those relationships between the dimensionless couplings. So let's say I took, I don't know, let's say I took the coefficient of the, remember, let's say, remember we have this example. So Susie says that this coupling, that lambda is equal to h squared. Okay, suppose I put by hand, lambda equals h squared plus 0.1. Okay? That's a very hard breaking of supersymmetry. Right? Very hard breaking. And further, of course, it would totally screw up the cancellation of quadratic divergences by 0.1, right? But really, in this low-energy theory, Susie's broken. There's no reason why these relations should be exact while we've not while we're messing the other things up. However, the shifts, the hard-breaking shifts in the couplings. Are, and this is why the soft terms are interesting, are suppressed by powers of ms over m. There are higher dimension operators that will give rise to these corrections. Everything here is suppressed by powers of fx over m, but these dimensionless ones will turn into fx over m squared, which is m soft over a capital M. So they're small. They're really tiny. They're tiny dimensionless effects. Of course, the soft masses are also tiny dimensionless effects in units of m, but they're very visible at low energies. That's why that's the difference between relevant low dimension operators and marginal operators. But these effects are there, and furthermore, they do screw up the cancellation of the quadratic divergences, but by such a tiny amount that it's actually small. You know, when you compute it, this theory is a cutoff m. And so the shifts are always tiny compared to what you can always of the same order as f of x mod squared and so on. which is, all right? So if we measure, let's say we discover low energy supersymmetry, but we really see that some of these SUSY, you know, a way of probing for where a next scale is to actually look to see how big the deviations in the hard parameters are. They're a probe into where the scale, where these higher dimension operators are generated are. But dominantly, we don't care about them. Dominantly, they're not a big deal. All right. But now we can write down the most general soft SUSY Lagrange. We can write down the most general supersymmetric Lagrangian with these soft SUSY breaking in it. And let me write it down in, I'll write this down in superspace because it's very instructive. And it gives a very nice way of thinking about what the soft terms are. Okay? So it looks like, after all we're going to have is, we'll have our phi dagger I e to the v phi, you know, usual crap here. Well, let me talk about each field. The e to the v's will be put in as needed. Okay, so I just don't want to clutter things with too much notation. But for every field, I can have, well, there's a coefficient 1, but there will be some effect that's coming directly from SUSY breaking, some soft effect from one of these operators. So let me write it down. Alpha I theta bar squared alpha I star minus theta squared theta bar squared mi squared. Okay? So that's the most general thing I can have in front of the kinetic term. These things, I don't know where they come from. They have mass dimension 1 that has mass dimension, m has mass dimension 1. There are some small scale. Now, I can have b squared theta 1 over g squared plus theta squared m gaugino over g squared w alpha squared. And, you know, in the superpotential, every term, for example, let's say I have a mass term for some chiral superfields phi I and phi j. Well, I'm just going to parametrize. There could be a theta squared term sitting in front of that, which I'll just call bij here. There could be a lambda ijk, phi I, phi j, phi k. And I will call this a ijk. And that's it. Well, if I have higher dimension operators here, I have the analogs here. But if I'm restricting myself to the renormalizable long-distance effective theory, then this is what the most general such theory looks like in written in superspace. Okay? Of course, it's not supersymmetric. All of these terms break supersymmetry, but I've given them familiar names. For example, this turns into what we call the soft mass. This turns into m squared phi star phi. Okay? This is what I call the A term, A phi I phi j phi k. That's the Gaugino mass, and so on. All right, but you see, there's something very pretty about this, because you notice that I can rewrite this, just rewriting it, but it gives a nice interpretation. I can rewrite this as the integral d4 theta phi I dagger e to the script vi phi I plus d squared theta a half s w alpha squared plus d squared theta mij phi I phi j plus lambda ijk phi I phi j phi k. See, all I'm doing is I'm just writing it down like it was a supersymmetric Lagrangian. Oh, don't confuse this v. This is a script v. Maybe I should call it z. I like calling it theta, but just the, okay? Now suppose, forget all of this, and suppose I just told you, write down the general superspace Lagrangian. Well, you would have written down phi dagger phi, and I would have said, maybe you should put a z factor up front there so you can keep track of the wave function. And you would say, okay, I can always rescale it later. So you write down z phi dagger phi, 1 over g squared, w alpha squared, m i j phi, you know, you'd write it all down. Okay? But every single one of those parameters, because of the structure of superspace, can actually naturally be continued to be a superfield. It could be, right? The mij and the lambda ijk could be superfields, chiral superfields. 1 over g squared could be continued to be something which is itself a chiral superfield, S. And the wave function normalization could be continued to be something which is a real chiral superfield, Z. It could be. Of course, it's supersymmetric, so all those superfields are just numbers. They don't have higher theta components. But you see that what soft Susy breaking is really just giving them the most general possible values. Okay? Soft Susy breaking is turning on the most general possible superfield couplings. When you turn the coupling constants into superfields in the only way they can be. Is that clear?
Okay.
It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Yes? Okay. So you think of lambda as a superfield, m as a superfield, s as a superfield, z as a superfield. Okay. If I write z as e to the v, it's actually more convenient. So again, do not confuse this with the actual vector of superfields. This is the wave function normalization, so I'm writing as a script v. You notice there's actually an amusing ambiguity, I can rescale phi I goes to e to the, let me call it lambda I phi I, vi goes to vi minus lambda I dagger. Okay, so I can make field redefinitions on the phis to change what the components of v look like, just like we talked about a second ago for the real gauge field. And so in fact, I can do that. To remove, so in general, v will look like theta, vi will look like theta squared alpha I plus theta bar squared alpha I star, where these are not the same alphas as there, let me call this hats, minus theta squared theta bar squared mi squared, okay? But I can always appropriately choose, I can choose the lambda I to just again, now just be theta squared, to remove these, but they'll reappear in the lambdas, okay? So if I do that, then, there's an equivalence, because under this you see the lambda ijk have to go to e to the minus lambda I plus lambda j plus lambda k, lambda I j k. You can think of these v's as some kind of background U1 vector superfield, okay? Under which phi I, every phi has its own private U1, and it has its own private background superfield. But you have to give a charge to the lambda I j k's, which is the opposite, the sum of the, and similarly for the m's. Okay. So the only physical things are then invariants under these. So, but writing it like this, we see that the mi squared phi star phi. So this comes from the v component of v. Things that look like A, I, J, K, phi I, phi J, phi K, so these are the A terms. Well, this is equal to the lambda I, J, K, so if I write this as lambda I, J, K, Let me write lambda ijk, the whole superfield, as little lambda ijk, e to the theta squared alpha ijk, or little a ijk. Mij as mij, e to the theta squared bijk, bij. So now I finally want to tell you what the actual soft terms in the Lagrangian are and how they're related to the various components of these higher superfields. So once again, I have mi squared phi star I phi I. This is the d component of vi. I have something that looks like lambda ijk, a ijk. This is called the A parameter, phi I, phi j, phi k. This, so aijk, this is m squared I, aijk is equal to the little aijk. Okay. In order to make things convenient, I'm going to do this gate transformation, the Spekel gate transformation, to remove the alpha star from here. So all I had was the d term. That's how I identified the d term up there. So when I do that, I see it's the little ijk here plus alpha I plus alpha j plus alpha k, okay, which I got from doing this transformation. And similarly, I get the bij. I get the term that looks like mij, bij, phi I, phi j. The bij is equal to little bij plus alpha I plus alpha j. Right. And then finally, I have the Gaugino mass, m lambda, lambda, lambda. And the Gaugino mass over g squared is nothing other than the theta squared component of f. Okay. So I have these background chiral superfields. And if you just tell me what they are, you tell me what v is, you tell me what s is, what the lambdas are, that immediately translates the sum set of soft parameters, okay, in the following way. Sorry? Yeah, so for example, in order to do that, I would have to write down derivatives in superspace. So something that something, for example, that looked like yeah, here's one. So, but again, you need, if you haven't seen derivatives, then maybe don't worry about it. But I can have things that look like, I don't know, d4 theta, d bar squared, x dagger. Oh no, here. D squared theta, d bar squared, x dagger, w alpha squared. So this d bar squared x. D bar squared, x dagger is a chiral, but there is some object that you can do in superspace that turns things into chiral superfields. Okay? So, but what this does, this just turns into a number. D bar squared x dagger is exactly f of x. Okay, so there is sum divided by m squared here. So d bar squared x dagger over m squared. Okay? So this just turns into a number. But it affects the Gaugino kinetic term and not the Gauge kinetic term, for example. that's an example of the sort of thing which gets you part three. But you have to have derivatives, extra derivatives in a two-inch space. Okay, very good. So, any theory of Susie breaking, any theory at all of Susie breaking, looks like this at low energies. And you should think of the soft terms as just turning on higher components for all the couplings in the theory promoted to being superfields in a natural way. Of course, these theta squared and theta bar squared components are all of the order of some scale. The general overall soft Susie breaking. Let me make one final comment. So this is what the low energy theory looks like, and we know what it looks like in components as well. The final thing is to tell you about the low energy theory may have one other guy, which is the Goldsteinov. Okay? We said that before. So if the original, notice another thing, sorry, very important point. The scale M soft is of order F over M, right? So this can be way smaller than the scale associated with F itself. Okay? So that's why it's possible to have Susie broken at a very high energy scale. But if it's transmitted to us sufficiently indirectly, then it can appear like we have just TED scale supersymmetry breaking down here. So this is what makes it possible for there to be any number of hierarchies between so the actual Susie breaking scale and what we see. It could be anywhere between right above our nose, right at the TED scale, supersymmetry is broken right here, transmitted right at the TED scale, everything is right there. That's one extreme. The other extreme is it could be incredibly far away. Okay, it could be 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11, might even be higher than that. Right? So that means that we can really run the gamut as we imagine all possible theories of supersymmetry breaking. We can really run the gamut from very light gravitinos to very heavy gravitinos compared to the TED scale. And since, as you've noticed, I'm not concentrating that much on specific underlying models, but only on what the universal long-distance theories will look like, all we have to do is consider the case where the Goldsteinov is light. As we'll see, that has a universal description. So here is M Susie, which in the real world is going to be a TEB. If the gravitino is around here, who cares? Who cares? Except cosmologists. But if the gravitino is very light, if the gravitino is down here, then I need to tell you about the Goldsteinov as well. So that's very easy, because once again, any theory which has spontaneous symmetry breaking, the couplings of the Goldstones are totally determined by symmetries. Simply, so let's just do it directly in the example we care about. So here's M squared phi star phi. I don't have to tell you what the whole theory is. I don't have to tell you where it came from. One way or another, you got M squared phi star phi. So this looks like it breaks supersymmetry, right? But we know when you've broken a symmetry, it's just being non-linearly realized. So if I include the Goldsteinov and see that it shifts under supersymmetry, then the whole Lagrangian should still be supersymmetric. So the way you do it is by simply, it's very similar to what we did in the first lecture. You do the symmetry transformation, and then you associate the symmetry transforming parameter with the Goldsteinov itself, with the Goldstone boson itself. Let's see how it works explicitly here. So if I make a Susie variation on this, it turns into M squared, let's say, phi star zeta psi. Boo-hoo. It's not supersymmetric. Okay? But I could make it supersymmetric if I added to this M squared phi star chi psi, where chi is the Goldsteinov. Okay? Because then with delta chi is equal to minus, and let me put a minus here. So with delta chi, is equal to zeta, then this is supersymmetric. Okay? If the Suzy variation of this cancels that Suzy variation. This is always the way you do it. You always, when you have a broken symmetry, you perform the broken symmetry on the broken Lagrangian, and then you elevate the symmetry transforming parameter to the Goldstone boson. Okay? And that guarantees that you have a nonlinear realization of the symmetry. So this is incredibly simple. We can do it with all the terms. Let's just do it with the scalar masses. So we just did it. So I really have to have minus m squared phi star chi psi. I can take the Gugino, okay, and I have minus m, and now I just have to take the variation of the Gugino, sigma mu nu, f mu nu, chi. Okay. That's how the Goldstone couples. So we know exactly how it couples. Yes, of course. That's what this is guaranteeing works. But this is a more pragmatic way of doing it. All right, great. Now, and remember the coefficient of the kinetic term of Goldstino was just the overall Suzy breaking scale. So if I want to go to some canonical normalization, I can. If I go to canonical normalization, then I have chi canonical I sigma bar d chi canonical, plus the interactions look like m squared over f, for example, phi star chi psi, or m over f lambda sigma mu nu f mu nu chi canonical. But in practice, what this does is give me a coupling between a particle, its superpartner, and the Goldstino. So phi, psi, chi, and this strength is m squared over f. That's a Yukawa coupling, but the strength is m squared over f. And similarly, between lambda, the photon, and chi, again. And this strength is m over f squared. And I don't care about the actual gravitino because, you know, its couplings are bound by one ring of Planck. So this means, for example, that one of these, let's say in the real world, one of the scalar superpartners or the Gugino's, they can decay to the gravitino. Or, sorry, they can decay to the Goldstino. And this even tells us what the width is. The width for the decay, for example, of phi to psi Goldstino is m squared over f squared times the mass of phi. And similarly, and it's really the same formula for the decay of the Gugino to its partner and the Goldstino. This goes like, again, it's m over f squared squared, but then still, just to make the dimensions come out right, it's m cubed. So in all cases, this is m to the fifth over f to the fourth, m to the fifth over f to the fourth. Why is this important? This is important because if the Goldstino is light, then every superpartner will eventually decay to its normal standard model particle and the Goldstino. And it's entirely possible that this scale is high enough that this decay is pretty slow. Okay. But if the scale is low, then the decay there's a whole variety of possibilities. The decay can be prompt. It can take a long time. But if we can get a handle on this decay rate one way or another, then it gives us a direct handle on where the actual real scale of supersymmetry breaking is. If the scale is, it turns out for the m's that we care about, if the scale is above 1,000 TeV, then this decay will always take place outside of the detector at the LHC. So that means, more or less, we don't know. It might happen eventually, but we're not going to see it directly. But if the scale is less than about 1,000 TeV, then this decay can take place inside the detector of the LHC. And then we have a direct handle on where the supersymmetry. Then we know the supersymmetry breaking scale is low, and we even have a handle. We can get some indirect handle on where it is. Okay, so that's it. So this is the most general, softly broken supersymmetric theory. We figured out what its Lagrangian looks like. We figured out what it looks like in superspace. And we also talked about if there's a Goldstino that's light as well, what its universal coupling is. So that's what any theory that breaks supersymmetry is going to look like this at low energies. So next time, we'll finally talk about the MSSF. We'll talk about the particular case of that we care about. I will actually start. I wonder if, I think I will do the following thing. In our little discussion session today, if you don't mind, if I can take 10 minutes at the start of that discussion session.
There isn't one.
Oh, there isn't one. Oh, okay. Very good. Okay.
Maria taking a dog.
Oh, right, that's right. Well, let me tell you what the issue is, okay? This way of thinking about the soft parameters, the background superfields, makes it trivial to understand all of the renormalization properties of SUSY. So, I mean, it's one of those small obstacles when you're first learning the subject that, everyone talks about renormalization group equations for the soft masses, and you've got to look them up in the literature and do all this stuff and get some intuition for what they look like. And that's, 50% of SUSY phenomenology, or a certain sort of not very good SUSY phenomenology, is about understanding what these RGs look like back and forth and running things up and down. And it's all pointless because you can solve it all analytically in 5 lines using these methods. Okay? And you can develop immediate intuition for them yourself, staring at these analytic formulas. So what I wanted to do by the end of today, but that's impossible, is just show you how that works. Okay? And then start talking about the MSSM physics tomorrow. So I guess I'll have to take 15 minutes tomorrow and show you how it works. All right, I'll just do that. Is there a discussion session tomorrow?
Yeah.
All right, very good. Okay, thanks.